Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.
Welcome back to America This Week. This is Tim Reedy sitting in for Father Matt Malone, who is taking a well-deserved vacation, and joined by Carrie Weber and our assistant editor here, Zach Davis. And we're going to bring Zach in now to talk to an article that's actually quite relevant to a project you've been working on, namely the relations in between the Vatican and the Chinese government in terms of the church in China.
That's right. So we had an article on our website at americamagazine.org that the a Vatican official hints at unofficial agreement with China on bishops. And so for people who might not know, one of the Vatican and the People's Republic of China do not have any diplomatic relations. And one of the big sticking points with the church there is how are bishops appointed? This, you know, came up periodically in Europe, you know, in the Middle Ages and whatnot. But in China, the government wants to be able to appoint leaders from within China, right? They don't want a foreign entity appointing leaders within China. And so one of the things that they've been working towards is how to come up with an agreement that makes both sides happy. There was a big hope that that was going to happen last year, and it sort of reached...
Yeah, I seem to remember hearing about
there's
this.
There's a lot of buzz, and something must have happened because they kind of hit the brakes on it. But this a senior Vatican official, Argentine Bishop Marcello Sanchez-Sorondo, he said, we need to make a distinction between the formal agreements, which are, you know, sounds like a lot of bureaucracy and hammering out details, and the real things that are happening. And that the fact is that, you know, China and the Vatican actually have pretty good a relationship. Pope Francis and Chinese President Xi Jinping are friendly. They, you know, famously exchanged greetings with each other after they were both elected within a short span of time within each other. They've sent gifts. The Pope has frequently mentioned that China is close to his heart, and this is a big deal for the Catholic Church.
Yeah, and you were talking about this specifically this weekend, weren't you, at a conference?
That's right. The U.S. Catholic China Bureau had its biennial conference at St. John's University in Queens, and so it brought together both American scholars and China watchers and also Chinese priests and nuns and seminarians to all kind of get together to learn about the church in China, what its needs are, how the American church can support it, how it can learn more about it. And it was a really, you come away from events like that feeling connected to the global church in a way that you don't previously.
Did you talk to people? You were in China doing some reporting mm-hmm. with Father Jeremy Zippel this past... When were you there? This summer?
June, yeah.
And did you find people talking about this relationship that you're describing from the article, the sense of, was that sort of current among the people in the pews, I guess, or is it more of a thing that's of concern to the hierarchy?
It's a big concern to the hierarchy that will have ramifications on the people in the pews. I think people doing the groundwork in China they're aware that this is happening and that this would make their lives easier, but the church is there isn't really an advocacy group. It recognizes that the political situation that it's in is what it's in. And so they're, you know, on the ground trying to figure out how to serve the people there, not just the Catholics there, but all of the people in China. And so you have a couple of bizarre phenomenons. Well, you know, urbanization is not a bizarre phenomenon. It's well known. But the way the church responds to that is something the church in China is still figuring out. Because you have a lot of cases where young people will go to the cities for university or for jobs, and you know, not the faith doesn't always go with them, and so you'll have these Catholic villages where generations have been Catholic, and there's two or three priests in the parish, and they're complaining, all the young people have left, and so there's not a ton of infrastructure because you know appointing bishops is so difficult, and.
Yes.
Bishops talking
so
to each other.
When they
is difficult.
Get to the city, they literally don't have anywhere to worship.
Well, there are places, but it's tough for Americans to get plugged into parishes. Mm-hmm. There's five churches in Beijing for a city of 25 million people.
Right.
So it can be really tough. Or if you know you're working at a factory and Sunday is just any other day in China, right? So you might have to work through the day. You can't go home to be with your family for mass or any type of community gathering. And so figuring out, and on the flip side, you have some villages in China that are so underserved that Chinese priest, a young Chinese priest, gave a presentation on Catholic village life, and he said that he spent about a month in a village where these families had called themselves Catholic because their family had been Catholic for generations, but there hadn't been a priest in the area for so long that they didn't know anything about Jesus or God. They didn't have any sacraments. The churches was all shuttered up. And so I don't know. And so these are the things that are, you know, really pressing concerns for people on the ground there.
Right. How does one's identity actually relate to what people are living out?
Yeah. And so we've got a project coming from America in the next couple months. So it's an introduction for the American Catholic Church on the church in China. So be on the lookout for that.
Yeah. Take a look at americamagazine.org. And we now have Father Jim McDermott on the line. We'll be talking with him. He is a contributing writer for us at America. He's a screenwriter. He's as I said, a kind of jack of all trades. And we're happy to have him with us today to talk about his newest article for us, which is Charlottesville and Trump, A Spiritual Exercise for the Overwhelmed and Exhausted. Father Jim McDermott, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Great to be with you guys.
We're very glad to have you. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the thesis for this article for folks who haven't yet read it, which might be a lot of people since we just posted it.
Sure. Aren't they
getting
updates?
They might be getting our RSS feed.
Listeners.
Yeah, it's possible.
Unless they follow you on Twitter, which some may. Pop Culture Priest. I'll throw it out there.
Jim, we definitely read it. Oh,
yeah. Okay, everyone here has read it.
No. Well, I guess my thesis is that I think Charlottesville is yet another moment and there have been many, actually, just even in the last couple of weeks, where there's so much sort of surprising stuff happening and so much creates such a response, such a strong response, that it becomes difficult to sort of parse. It's hard not to get caught on that wave and to try to, it's very hard to step back and say, okay, what am I seeing? What do I find is important? You just kind of, outrage is like a fire, you know, once it starts, it just burns everywhere. So my thought was to look at Charlottesville and sort of the way that it's being talked about, the many ways that it's being talked about, and then to suggest something from the Jesuits, a sort of a spiritual exercise that we use to try to help us keep some perspective in the midst of our lives.
Right. So this is the kind of spiritual self-examination, this examine where you take a look and say, you know, where were you today, Lord? What happened? What do you want me to notice?
And you suggest like on your news feeds or CNN, which is not a place people might be normally looking for God.
No, exactly. But you know, right. And it's right now, it doesn't maybe seem like he's there, but he is, right. We believe God's everywhere, but that it's always hard, even whether it's on CNN or just in our lives, to kind of pay attention, like where are the breadcrumbs? So that's exactly what this exercise is about. It's just sort of like in terms of say CNN, say you watch, or Fox, say you watch them before you turn it on, to just take a moment and put yourself in the presence of God, right? A moment for peace, a moment for gentleness, and to ask God, you know, okay, help me see you. Help me see what's important as I listen to this, or how I'm feeling even as I listen to this, because our feelings tell us stuff. And then after we're watching, or maybe even while, but especially after, or we're trolling through our Twitter feeds or Facebook or whatever, to then go back and again, take a moment and say, you know, God, okay, show me where you were. Show me what was important. I just saw 3,000 reactions and memes about whatever today's sort of difficult sort of news report was. What's the thing for me? What's the thing that I need to walk away with, or the response that you seem to be inviting me to in my life? And, you know, might be getting involved, right? It might be just being more kind, or not responding as quickly to the things that you see on our feeds. I know for me, like on Saturday, at first I'm just watching it, that's sort of my feed. And then I'm like, you know, typing away, rage, rage, rage. Like it makes total sense. But when you step back, is that who you want to be? Is that who you're called to be? You know, and for different people, it's different at different times.
Jim, how does an Ignatian spirituality negotiate the, you know, internal feelings that you might be having about something with the outside realities? I think one of the tendencies is for people to kind of be like, oh, there's so much negativity, news is too depressing, I just don't pay attention to it, or I'm just gonna, you know, try to improve myself little by little, which seems to me to kind of lack. It's a good thing, of course, but what would an Ignatian informed spirituality say about how to negotiate these things?
Well, let me say two things. One is, like, you know, Ignatian spirituality, like one of the catchphrases is a contemplative in action. So you got to have time for both. I think, you know, the press and our own, and sort of our own internal at times sense of outrage, those things sort of tell us you have to be in the moment watching everything constantly. And that's, I think everyone needs breaks. I mean, we can't live with our head in the sand, right? But nobody expects, including God, for us to be like crawling the feed, trying to ride the wave constantly. There has to be that. It's a constant give and take between being in the moment and sort of invested in what's going on around you, and then being able to step back and sort of go back through it or savor it and try to figure out to sort of chew it over, like what was the important stuff. So that's one thing, that contemplative and action, those are both important pieces. In terms of like that question about feelings, I mean, what we kind of sort of the heart of the Jesuit spirituality, the Ignatian spirituality, the spiritual exercises, is the idea that God speaks through our feelings. So it's really important to pay attention to them. So if I'm watching my feed or I'm watching CNN and I'm getting really angry, you know, so that's like a negative feeling, right? You might think, oh, that's something to put aside or can't be of God. But no, Ignatius would say it's the strong feelings that are the most important. So if you're getting really angry or you're getting really excited or really happy, like when you have a moment to step back, those are the things to go back to and sort of ask yourself or ask God. I always think it's, you know, self-examination makes it seem like I have to figure out to myself, but no, and in a spiritual way, you put that, you bring that to God, you offer that to God and say, okay, look what I found. What is it? You know? And then hopefully God helps us to sort of see like, oh yeah, that's a piece of, that's zinc, unfortunately, but that's gold. And the gold might be your rage. You know, it might be that there's, what God's trying to tell you is that, there's something here that's really angering and triggering you that's important and that you need to act on, or that you need to, or I need to pay more attention to as I, you know, go through my day or the next day or the next day.
Yeah. And that sense of the next day and the next day and the next day gets to the heart of what you're writing about as well, which is this sense of sometimes being just overwhelmed by all of this. And it's not just sort of one action or event that we then sit down and process, and while we're processing, everything else around us is calm. It's, you might be processing all of this in the midst of another crisis or another tragedy in our nation, and it can get really raw and difficult to do it in that context.
Absolutely, and that's part of why I initially sort of twigged to that idea that it's got to be, there has to be the entering into it and also the time for withdrawing from it, because, you know, however you feel about the political situation of our country, it's really uncharted territory where it really is every week something very serious is happening, and it's the kind of thing that might happen once every 6 months in the past. It's literally happening pretty much every week, and that it's impossible, I think, impossible not to be exhausted in the midst of that and anxious and just, you know, and angry, whether you, you know, it doesn't matter what side you're on. It's sort of like, it just naturally agitates. So in that sort of a situation, and there's no, you know, it seems like that's our status quo for at least the time being, right? Maybe things will settle down, but they haven't yet. So it's more and more important, whether it's something like a spiritual exercise, like I suggest, or some other way that each of us, where we find like a moment of peace, a moment of quiet and of gentleness, like, I think we each have to, what do they call that? The secret garden. We each need a secret garden right now. And we shouldn't live there all the time, but we definitely need one to just continue to nourish us and keep us from becoming our outrage, in a sense, or becoming our fear.
Now, Jim, I wonder, Father Jim, you could lead us through it. We were just talking earlier on the show about the decision whether to preach on this on Sunday morning. And What were your initial, like, lead us through what happened when you heard this news? Like, was your initial instinct to go on social media, to follow it, to weigh in on social media? And then how did you transition to thinking about, am I going to talk about this in any way on Sunday?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know how I heard about it on social media. I think I was just, I was working and, you know, taking a break, and then there it all is. I weighed in pretty fast. I was sort of reluctant and then felt like, well, actually for me, the thing I wanted to think about, and that's kind of what I started writing about, was what's the role of church in all of this? And maybe sort of prescinding from our forward motion, but maybe stepping back first to say, like, I'm going to guess most of the people that were carrying Nazi paraphernalia, et cetera, are Christians. I'm going to guess that overwhelming majority of them were either raised Christian and or probably claimed to be Christian. And a lot of different kinds of Christianity, right? But none would agree with that stuff. And so then I was thinking about that. So the reality of groups like this and their seeming sort of growing strength, to me, that poses a major questions for the church, for all churches, about both our efficacy. Like, are we really, we don't seem to be reaching these people. In fact, and what's even worse, that they would, I think, oftentimes be using Christian or Catholic teaching as a sort of a justification for some of what they're doing. Like, I'm sure there were people shouting that the Jews killed Jesus, right? Like, that's just de rigueur for sort of the Nazi anti-Semitic. I mean, and the Catholic Church, the Christian community from the beginning, you know, we're implicated in things like that. So that's what I was doing, was thinking about, like, how are things that we've done in the past as Christian communities or continue to teach in the present, the ways that we talk about certain groups, how are we sort of implicated in what's going on in Charlottesville and other places? And then right, like, what's the forward momentum? So for me, I mean, I would love to see the USCCB, the Catholic bishops, think about having some sort of synod within the American church on sort of these sorts of questions, on whether it's on race or it's on sort of notions of the other, which is an incredibly abstract way to put it, but like the various groups that we consider as not a part of ourselves and the way that Catholicism should help those communities in the United States or hasn't adequately done so.
Jim, we're going to transition here to talk about a piece you wrote for us back in July about a controversy, and I think it's related here, at some of the Disney parks, about how much the stories that are told there should kind of change over time or kind of be based in any kind of reality or should be, you know, or should they be pure places of escape? And I'm thinking back to your conversation earlier in the episode about, you know, those secret gardens that people look for. You know, Disney is that place for a lot of people, but the question is, how long do you stay in that secret garden versus kind of entering the real world?
Yeah, the controversy that Disney's faced is, you know, it has that Pirates of the Caribbean ride, which came long before the movies and has always been very popular. All its parks, not just the one in California, has that. And, you know, from the outside, if you were just to describe that ride, it has some troubles. I mean, it's basically pirates showing up at a town or an island, burning it to the ground, and pillaging, and if that were not enough, taking the women, and the implications earlier were even worse as to what they did with the women, but what they had kind of landed on in recent decades was what they call the wench, well, I think it's a wench sale or the wench swap.
Wench auction, I believe.
Wench auction, where women are, you see, and everyone's smiling, it's hilarious. Women are being sold to drunk pirates who are leering and hanging around. And, you know, it's cartoonish, right? So, and for the longest time, it doesn't seem like it received that much of much blowback, but it has. And over time, Disney has debated that, and they don't like to change things, especially in California, because most of the people who come to Disneyland in California are locals, and they come all the time. So you change the color of one tile in one room, and people are writing about it. It really, they're very intent on keeping that experience the same as when they were kids. But they decided to change the wench auction, to take it out, and instead, I think what they're doing is they're one of the women, sort of the most prominent character in that auction, is becoming a pirate herself. And she's joining them.
Oh, I didn't realize this. There's like a whole development of
like
a story.
About
she will be
too.
Burning down
Absolutely.
The villages.
Exactly. So it's okay.
Right.
Equal opportunity pillaging for everyone.
Charlize Theron will be playing her in the movie.
Right, exactly. So people were very upset. In part, I think actually a lot of it is because they want it the way they always had it, and they didn't think it was that big a deal.
Until you think about what's actually happening.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right.
It's. I mean, the thing I said in the article was, it's like, you know, the picture of the old woman, and then when you look at it a different way, it's like a young woman sitting in a chair.
Right.
You know, those like,
yeah, they're
like line drawings.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Once you see it the other way, you can't unsee it.
Right.
So I think that's what happened at Disneyland, is they got to a point where they said, wow, they began to understand that this other way, which is like how this actually happens in history, and then it was impossible to just continue to accept it, because that version is not at all what Disneyland's about.
Right.
You know?
Well, and that's
Disneyland wants to be the happiest place on earth.
And it's a place where people go with their families. So like, you know, your son or daughter sitting there like, oh, what's going on there? How do you, I don't know. I guess people have been trying to explain it to kids for decades or no kid has ever noticed. I don't know. But it's got to be really hard to talk about with your kids. And I mean, which is, I think, a common theme with a lot of things these days. The wench auction at Disneyland being the least among them, you know, in terms of difficult topics. But yeah, it's how to put some of these really difficult topics into the context of talking to young people about it, and how that shapes another generation's view of it. I think,
that's such a great point. I mean, there are so many. I find I have nephews and nieces, and I'm constantly thinking, wow, I wonder how my brother and sister-in-law or my sister and brother-in-law are dealing with this, you know, this question, explaining this topic. It's a very, right, yeah. And Disney doesn't want to be a part of that, right? That's definitely not, they want to present a vision of America. I think that's very much a part of what they do. That's very hopeful and optimistic and communitarian, small town communitarian. You know, whenever you walk into a Disney park, you always walk through Main Street, and it's at least at Disneyland and I think at Disney World, it's based on Walt Disney's small town where he grew up. Like, that's important to their understanding, but that's built around acceptance and a sense of us caring about and trying to help one another. That's the heart of that vision. So things that sort of undermine that or draw us into the political debates of today are just things that Disney they don't want anything to do with.
Right, they're being forced to deal with it in the animatronic version of Donald Trump in their Hall of Presidents, which certainly doesn't.
Yeah, that too has been.
That's been a bit of a debate.
Can't wait for that speech he's going to give.
Well, I don't think he gets to write it, but I don't know. I mean, that was a debate over the rumors were that there was conflict between Disney and the Trump administration about the content. And then there were rumors that they were just going to stop having the president talk. So he'd be there. He's the president, just like all the others. But there would be no talking part. But they say that's going forward. And I agree. It will be that's at Disney World. It'll be very interesting to see how they put that together. And I think his presence, unfortunately, in a way that's different than maybe some other presidents, although maybe not. Maybe, you know, for different people, maybe Bill Clinton or George W. Bush would have caused a similar amount of consternation to see them,
right,
or other
right.
presidents, for that matter.
Tim, have your daughter is six now? How old is she?
Seven.
Seven, yeah. Have you had to talk to her about any of the things going on in the world right now?
Not about the... I think we went on the Pirates of the Caribbean a couple of years ago, but I admit I didn't notice this. I guess I should have.
Were you in Disney World or Disneyland?
I was in Disney World.
Ah.
Maybe they don't have it. It's just Disneyland.
There's a chance, yeah.
No, okay. I think they. I don't know.
I think Disney World has it too. In fact, they're changing it first, but their Pirates of the Caribbean is slightly different than the Disneyland. Okay.
But in terms of non-pirate related topics, like in terms of politics or the presidency or race, have you had conversations with her about this?
I mean, I think around the time of the election or the morning after the election, there were, I think, a lot of parents having that conversation with their kids, like. For her, it was, you know, a big deal to have a woman running for president. So when she lost, she was upset about that. Now, she's only 7. I know I'd heard from families with older kids who it was much more difficult. Like,
right.
You know, women and young women in high school. And that was a very hard thing for them. But, yeah, I mean, it's a continuing conversation. You know, it comes up now and then. I suspect it'll come out more often. We're not sitting around watching CNN at night together, I'll tell you that. But
no, that doesn't sound
I mean,
like
it's
a
hard question because you want to be politically engaged and you want to encourage that among your children. But, I would think twice about, you know, sitting down and watching the evening news given what's going on. So
and how much you'd have to explain or how many questions you'd have to answer that we're having trouble answering, never mind explaining them to a kid.
Right. Yeah, it's not easy.
Well, it's funny too, like those shows, whatever network it is, the behavior is really not the behavior you want in general. You want your kids to pick up, right? You see, these adults are not talking to one another oftentimes in a way that we teach our kids to treat one another.
Right, in a civil way, right.
Yeah, the you know, Scaramucci so interview is like not going to be bedtime reading.
Goodness, no.
Yeah, no, it's really, really, it's tough. And I guess it. I don't know. Do you think that places that it's helpful that these kinds of changes, like we're talking about at Disney, do help further that conversation, or do you think it's sort of Disney deciding that this is not in their best interest for marketing, or do you think they're really kind of motivated to change that conversation?
So I've had the chance to actually meet, and I had a class at UCLA with Disney execs, and where we would have different people coming in every week. My sense is they are actually motivated. They really believe in the sort of the spirit of Disney that's behind the place. Of course, there's a huge profit motive as well. But so I think actually their decisions are based on more than – they actually want the place to be a good thing for people. And so I think there's an opportunity for them. I'm not sure that they've taken it entirely with the Pirates of the Caribbean to really use this as a moment. I don't know if education's not exactly the right word, but to sort of say this is who we are. But having said that, the people who kind of look at this as just another example of sort of politically correct, sort of left-leaning nonsense, it's pretty tough to I think they've kind of got that bone in their jaws, and so it's. I'm not sure that. Those are the people they would be reaching. I'm not sure that those people, if that's kind of where you land on anything like this, that it's all about identity politics or, and having said that though, I sometimes I think that critique doesn't get enough time. Maybe it's put in the wrong places, but there is a way in which sometimes we moral posturing is, that's what that critique is really about at its best. It's moral posturing, trying to say it's not really caring about the people concerned or the issues concerned as much as saying like we're better than X or better than Y. And it's very difficult for that position to get an airing, especially right now, especially with this president. But I feel frustrated sometimes for those people who are making that argument because they're so quickly discounted, and I don't think that helps anyone either. In the long run.
Right. That's in some cases, there might be people who are concerned more about how they are perceived than about the issue, kind of.
Well, because I think part of the
problem... Yeah, you know that phrase... go ahead.
Well, I was just saying, I think part of the problem is the way it's depicted in such a lighthearted way, right? Because you can, like, escape to fantasy and see injustice in fantasy novels or fiction that make you reflect on real injustices happening in political structures in real life, right?
Oh, absolutely. The Harry Potter books would be a great example mm-hmm. of that.
But Disney, I mean, doesn't want you thinking about that at all.
Yeah, that's probably... I think that's probably true. Yeah, I mean, you could say, and this is, I think, probably a highly debatable point, but I think they would argue that the way that they... the sort of the Disney princesses thing is in part an attempt... It is sort of addressing the sort of political issue of the place of women in society. Now, again, some would say, yeah, but it's placing them in this sort of petite sort of in some ways domesticated role. But I don't know, I would say contemporary Disney tries more and more to like to really raise up women and see them as
I just watched Moana.
Yeah, that's supposed to be a good example.
She was a adventurer, she was independent, she was pretty rockin'. it was Father Luke Hansen, what a newly ordained Jesuit priest, the subject of his first homily began with Moana. Which was surprising, but it was appropriate in the context.
Lin-Manuel was involved, right? So
he was, but he didn't write all the songs. Okay. He only wrote a couple of songs, the most popular one. I mean, anything Lin-Manuel Miranda does these days seems to be worth our time.
Exactly.
But it is. I mean, it is, and I think if you're making movies like Moana, which has a really strong female lead, it's really hard to reconcile that with the wench auction at the Pirates of the Caribbean. So it makes sense that, you know, if this is where they're devoting their time and their energy and their money these days, that would be...
You think of the Star Wars films, the newest, The Force Awakens or Rogue One, with the strong female leads, the incredibly diverse cast that don't seem like diversity for the sake of diversity. Like, those characters were, you know, incarnate and interesting. And I mean,
yeah, exactly.
It would raise controversy, but they're really... There's a real commitment behind doing things like that.
Indeed. And thank you, Father Jim McDermott, for your commitment to us, to our show, to the magazine. We are out of time at the moment. But if you want to hear more from Father Jim, from any of our writers, or from us, if you haven't heard enough yet, you can go to americamagazine.org and you can subscribe 1-800-627-9533. Thank you and have a great day.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.